This is Ian Hampton, recorded at the Hope Bay Reunion in Coniston by Chris Eldon Lee on the 21st of October 2009. Ian Hampton, Part 2.
When the main sledging programme was over and everybody had come back to base and it was approaching Christmas time, and there was still survey work to be done, which involved the Joinville Island and surrounding islands, which you've probably heard about. And I had quite a tussle within myself as to what I should do. I could have stayed on base and done nothing except my base experiments or whatever, and I knew that nobody would have thought the less of me for doing that. But, you know, rather like the fighter pilot that's shot down and he's told by his commanding officer to get in the next plane, and you know, I felt that really I ought to do something. And I believe I asked Neil, you know, if I could have one last trip in the field and go over to Joinville Island, which he agreed with, and I went. Now, not the nicest of places. I don't know if anybody's talked to you about it, but I mean it's fairly well north, so in the summer it's quite warm, and also notoriously bad weather. So in terms of cloud, I mean not necessarily storms. So I mean I could predict that it was not going to be a marvellous experience in terms of scenery and all of that sort of thing. But it was not too easy to find a place to land on the island and get the sledge and stores off and so on. And when the time came to move off, it was low cloud, and the snow was really very soft and slushy. And here we were heading up into the unknown. There were no proper maps. Heading up into the clouds in soft snow, I mean, a ready-made situation for a serious accident of the time that we'd had before. And I've never before or since been so scared and during those first couple of hours, maybe, you know, getting up above the low altitude, melting snow and so on, and you know, not going where we were. I mean, not knowing where we were going, not being able to see anything, and you know, having to travel on until we came to a fairly level sort of place where we could make a camp. So, I mean, I think you know that rounds it off for me. That's a sequel to the story.
But that was worse than being trapped in a crevasse, was it?
Well, because I was fully conscious. And my imagination was working overtime. Yeah.
Whilst we're talking about near disasters, there was a fire.
Yes.
What was the story of that?
Well, we believe the cause of it was a cigarette end which fell between the stone hearth on which the stove was standing. I mean, it was in the annex we'd built for looking after the dogs. We called it the harness room, and some people had been in there that evening mending harnesses or doing something, and we suppose that somebody must have flicked a cigarette and it fell into the dust in this crack and started smouldering, and it had burnt down. And next door was the lavatory, which was really quite a small room, it had started. The paint had started to singe, and early in the morning, Ron Miller woke up. I mean, he must have smelt something, I suppose, and went and saw, or maybe smoke or something like that. And I can remember him coming back into the bunk room and saying in a very quiet voice, "Fire, chaps!" And you know, everybody then leapt out of bed, and proceeded to do everything wrong. I think because there were quite a few communicating doors, you know, down the hut, and one of the and the easiest access tank of water was at one at the end of the hut opposite to the fire, and so people were carrying buckets of water up and down, and to make it easy they left all the doors open, so immediately the whole hut was filled with black oily smoke, and the only way you could get around was on your hands and knees with your, you know, your nose close to the ground. And the problem was that the fire was in a very restricted area, and it was very hot. And the only way into the lavatory was through the door. And every time the door was opened, oxygen flowed in, and there was almost an explosion, and flames shot out, encouraging one to just shut the door again. And we went through all the buckets of water from the tank, most of the fire extinguishers. But I mean, during this time, I mean, there were you know, quite a few amusing incidents. I mean, we'd had hurried discussions about what we should do. I mean, there was a suggestion that we might use heavy axes and try and cut the hut in half and isolate the part where the fire was. Another thing was we thought we should try and get access to the water in the kitchen, you know, the kitchen tank, which at that point was intact because it was very close to where the fire was and therefore not so accessible. And I I made my way into the kitchen, and I was filling a bucket from the tank. And I became aware that there was somebody else in there. And apparently, in the meantime, somebody had knocked in the kitchen window and had clambered in through the kitchen window. And I said to this person, I can't remember who it was, "What on earth are you doing there?" And this person said, "I'm filling the fucking kettle," he said. "If I know you lot, we shan't have enough water for a cup of tea." So, yeah, that was one thing.
How was the fire finally extinguished?
Well, by great presence of mind on the part of one person. We used up all the carbon dioxide fire extinguishers in a conventional sort of way, and this had had no effect whatsoever. But Bill Tracy was using the last cylinder, and there are some differences of opinion as to what happened next. But anyway, the top came off the cylinder, and CO2 started spurting out of the cylinder in an unregulated sort of way as he held it in his hands. And with great presence of mind, he threw the cylinder through the lavatory window. And, of course, within seconds, this small space was filled with carbon dioxide. The fire was out. You know, all credit to him. I was really great, great presence of mind.
Listen. You will have known, of course, the story of the 1948 fire.
Yes.
So presumably that focused the mind rather.
In what respect? I mean, it hadn't encouraged us to consider what would happen if the hut caught fire, and you know whether we ought to institute fire drill. I mean, I can't. This is not fact, but you know, the sort of thing that would have happened would have been, afterwards, we might have said, "Well, we were luckier than that couple down the road." I don't remember there being any discussion of our incident in relation to them.
So there were no lessons being learned from either their loss or your close shave?
I don't recall. No, I mean, I don't recall there being discussions about fire safety in the same way as there had been over crevasses, for example. You know, much earlier on, at at the beginning of the stay. I don't remember fire being actively considered as a possible hazard which we should prepare for.
The fire you suffered in 1960, was it?
Yeah.
That didn't change anything? When any new regulations came in?
I don't remember. No, I don't remember there being so.
Okay, thank you. You were there when Fids became Bass.
Yeah.
Did you notice?
The only thing that I noticed was we got a pay rise. And, you know, whether there was any connection between those two things, I really don't know. No, I mean, we were very remote. These were administrative changes that were taking place. I was not aware of there being any directive from on high that suggested we should operate in a way differently to what we'd been doing already.
You went back 20 years later when Bass was in full swing. What were the significant changes between the two visits?
Well, it was not with Bass. This was something completely independent, and that was actually with the French. Well, the changes... I mean, one always thinks that life progresses, and the progressive changes that I noticed were undoubtedly with you know, communications and its various guises. The ship we were on, which is the Tala Dan, which is an ice-strengthened vehicle, had access to satellite photographs, so they knew about the distribution of ice, and if they wanted to check on leads or thickness of the ice and so on, they had a helicopter on board to fly it. And the other thing was just before I left Australia, actually my wife slipped on some ice outside the back door of our house and broke her leg. And so there was a question then of what I should do. Whether I ought to fly back to England and support my wife. And I knew that if I did that, then that was the expedition finished as far as I was concerned. Or if I should carry on, and if I carried on, were there any special needs that I would have? And so, rather reluctantly, I mean, with quite a sore heart, I decided to carry on. But I said, well, I think I have to say that half of this expedition was to do with psychological aspects of exploration, as well as the physiology that I was interested in. And one of the things that I wanted to require was that I should have constant contact with my wife whenever I wanted it. And, of course, that absolutely destroyed the isolation side of things for me. Mm. But they agreed to it. The expedition chiefs agreed to it. And so as we were approaching the Antarctic, as I say, you know, with the photograph, the satellite photograph of the ice and the helicopter whirring overhead, I was sitting up on the bridge with a telephone, talking to my wife, who was in bed in Leeds General Infirmary. And, I mean, that was out of the question 20 years before.
So in 20 years, the Antarctic had become part of the rest of the world?
Had opened up, yes, 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 had absolutely opened up. And, of course, now, I mean, there's a transfer of data between the field in the Antarctic and the base. I mean, things
at
just
Cambridge.
Go... At Cambridge, yes, or wherever. I mean, there are other nations in the Antarctic as well, and they, you know, they're transmitting their data back to base.
When you went back, where did you go in the '80s?
To Terra Deli,
which is
it's on the other side of the continent. It's near the next door to the Australian sector that Mawson called the home of the blizzard. And the French have a station there at Dumont-d'Urville. And they have a big national Antarctic programme.
And that, what year was that to you?
It was the winter, the summer of 1881.
Had the magic gone?
If it hadn't gone, it was pretty quickly destroyed, because this was by far the most stressful thing I have ever, ever, ever done in my life. And I wouldn't want to repeat it. And it was the psychology that destroyed it. I mean, I'm sure that the psychologists would say that it was a very successful expedition, because in their intent to impose stress on people and see what the results were, they were absolutely successful. And as a result of that, the expedition physically didn't achieve what it set out to do, and much to the annoyance of the French, who were mainly a glaciological expedition, and they had certain set objectives about where they wanted to do and ice cores they wanted to drill and all of that sort of thing, which they weren't about to do. But it was even more of a, as far as organisation was concerned, it was even more of a tin pot expedition than FIDS had been in my day, because no nation would openly support it, even though it was called the International Biomedical Expedition to the Antarctic, and it was supported by the Antarctic divisions of the Argentine, France, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. Britain refused to have anything to do with it at all. I think this was a Fuchs hangover, actually, but, never mind. And it was organised through the Human Adaptability section of the Scientific Committee for Antarctic Research, and the vehicles between that organisation and people actually going on the expeditions were the various medical officers, senior medical officers of each of the nations. And they just scrammaged around and found whatever they could that we would require to keep ourselves going, with the exception of the Argentines. And the Argentines just provided $10,000, and that was it, finish. The British, we got a grant from the Wellcome Foundation. The French supplied all the food, which were surplus army rations, which had been designed for eating in metropolitan France, not in the Antarctic. And they also supplied some equipment. They applied two tents, which were dreadful, absolutely dreadful tents. The Australians supplied clothing, which was, on the whole, was quite good. And the New Zealanders, I've forgotten what their contribution was.
What
now.
Was it, what was the main thrust? What was the main point of this?
Well, it was really a carry-on of the ideas extant in the Medical Research Council that we started off with, that there have been lots of studies of the physical sciences in the Antarctic, but there's been no study which has been directed towards man himself and how does the man react. And by now it was understood that there are psychological reactions as well as physiological reactions, and it was thought that it was necessary to have an expedition whose sole purpose was the investigation of these two things. But we had to have an infrastructure, and the French Expedition Polaire Française, and they were called, they unwillingly supplied the infrastructure, in that they agreed that we could attach ourselves onto their glaciological expedition. Oh, the Japanese supported us as well, I remember. They provided vehicles.
But the idea was to push people to their limits.
Yeah, yes, yes. And, I mean, it was, in theory and on paper, it really was our ideal, my ideal, and the particular person that I'd worked with at the Medical Research Council had been down to the Antarctic himself, and, we, between us, used to train the FIDS doctors with research programmes and so on. You know, this is, it on paper, it was exactly what we said should be done, because it was controlled by quite a long experimental period at the Institute of Health, I think it was called, at Sydney University. We had 6 weeks of experiments there. Then there was the field period in the Antarctic, and then back in Australia again to do the wind-up experiments. And, you know, they were all proper human physiology experiments. But the stress, my God, the stress, because they, you know, all middle-aged people, you know, like me, with some sort of standing, all competing one with the other. So, you know, I mean, it was dreadful.
So the stress was amongst the scientists and the medics, not amongst the subjects?
Well, we were our own subjects. I mean, this is, yes, I mean, this is the great tradition of human physiology. You know, you do experiments on yourselves.
Did any good come of it?
Well, I have to say yes. There was a book written, and numerous scientific papers. But speaking personally, I didn't do what I should have done in writing the results of my work up fully. It was all published, but in short form. And the reason really was the changes that were taking place in British universities afterwards. I mean, there was such pressure at British universities to get on with one's normal job and get grants and teach millions of students and all of that sort of thing, that winding up this kind of research, just, it was too much. You know, I just couldn't do it, and so it just got left. I did promise myself that when I retired, I would do it. But no, there are other things in life.
One final question. Tell me about Hampton Bluffs.
Well, I owe it to Chris, really.
Chris Brading.
Yes, Chris Brading. It's just a rocky outcrop on the northern side of the Larsen Inlet, which is closest to where I went down the crevasse. And I mean, I didn't have anything to do with it, but he was surveyor. He had to recommend place names, and he chose it. I feel very, very grateful to him for that, because. What sense you mean? Or on photographs? There don't seem to be any photographs of it. But I think both he and I would like to see photographs, because the mountain that we had climbed just previous to the accident has been named Mount Brading, and it was from the top of this mountain that we'd viewed this prospective route down the glacier, and you know had decided that it was doable. Unfortunately,
you're proud of it.
Of what?
Having a bit of the Antarctic named after you.
Yes, yes, yes.
And even more so because it's not posthumous.
Oh, well, I suppose so, yes. You know, when you get older, you begin to philosophise a bit. And I remember, you know, when my mother and father died, I was the executor to their wills. And as you went about your business, you're closing bank accounts and all of that sort of thing, little by little, you wipe off all evidence that they ever existed. And you know, when I'd finished, there was nothing left. I mean, they both asked to be cremated, so there's no gravestone. My sister and I decided that we'd have a seat put in our local park. So that, I mean, there is something, but you know, it's not much really, for two lives that together lasted 170 years. So you then think about yourself. You know, what am I here for? What should I expect to do? And will there be anything left when I've gone? And I feel quite proud of the fact that so long as there is civilization and there are libraries with scientific journals and with atlases and so on, people can browse in there and say, oh, Hampton, wondered who he was. You know, I mean, I'll be there. I mean, it's only a small thing, but it's something.
If they want to know who you were, all they have to do now is listen to the Bass Archivist.
Well.
Ian, thank you very much indeed.
That's a pleasure.
Thank you. Mm.